Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls tonight until we ask for calls, because we have with us our good friend Bill Sardi, who supports Radio Liberty, and we're going to be talking about, well, you've been reading a lot in the newspaper about the terrible threat of another major flu epidemic. And they've had an outbreak of an avian flu over there in the Far East, and last thing I heard, 45 or 50 people had contracted the disease and died, but they got it from the ducks and from the fowl, and there was only perhaps one or two cases of person-to-person transmission. But suddenly we're being told there's a terrible danger, there's going to be a worldwide flu epidemic, it's only a matter of time. And well, I'm going to let Bill Sardi pick up the story from there as we begin analyzing why they're working so hard to create panic all across the United States, when there's only been one or possibly two instances where this has been person-to-person transmission. Bill, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
It's an exciting time to give you this report, because we're almost barraged daily, weekly, about reports about an upcoming flu pandemic. We don't know what to do. There are certainly no vaccine available for it. They're trying to make a 2 million doses of a flu vaccine that might protect against something called H5N1 strain of the influenza virus, but those won't be available to most people. The CDC, after many years of preparation, says it's still not prepared to fight any such global pandemic that they keep warning of. But oddly enough, never in history, never throughout all of history, have viruses from animals jumped to humans, except when man learned how to manipulate the genes themselves. So it brings great question as to whether these are man-made occurrences. And we keep being warned of this flu virus that's jumped to this bird virus that's now jumped to less than 100 people in Asia. Now the question, just because it jumps from animal to man doesn't mean it necessarily gets transferred from human to human, but the question is, why is this occurring? And then, of course, everything all changed in the February 24th issue of Nature magazine, when biologist Henry Nyman, who works for a biotechnology company, was examining flu virus gene sequences that had been placed on a public gene bank. This is a public database in New Mexico, run by the World Health Organization, where various researchers can insert in a computer database sequences of genes for influenza viruses so we can examine various strains. What Nyman found was a strain of human flu virus that was created in 1933 in a London lab by scientists who at the time were kind of investigating the global flu pandemic of 1918. This sequence that was created in 1933 and was a human strain was found in a pig virus out of South Korea. How did a mutated human flu virus get inserted into a pig in South Korea? That's what biologist Henry Nyman wanted to know. That's what researchers all over the world wanted to know. This finally erupted after weeks of emails. Who's doing this and why?
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Bill Sardi, and Bill is talking about the fact that we're finding, or it had been found, that there was a human manufactured flu virus in a pig. Now, how did something which is in the laboratory get into a pig in South Korea? Obviously, somebody had to put it there, unless somehow it got out of the laboratory. But these things are kept under lock and key, so why would it be there? And the question that arises, are they perhaps experimenting? We know that they've experimented with lots of these various organisms, and we can give you example after example where they've been used on human beings, experimental procedures done in prisons, where of course sometimes these organisms have actually got into the general community and created really disastrous results. We have all sorts of new diseases today we did not have 50 years ago. They just didn't exist, at least not in the form they are today. So I share your concern, Bill. Why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, as the report goes, each of the strains of the human mutated flu virus, it says, were genetically manipulated, contained genetic bits of an avian virus, unlike those now prompting separate bird flu concerns. Nothing even remotely related to this flu strain has circulated the world since 1956, so there would be certainly great concern because very few people would have immunity to it. And these, as the quote goes in the report, these sequences could represent a military experiment that resulted in an unplanned release. Moreover, bioterrorism cannot be ruled out. If you go to my website, we're asking the question at AskBillSardi.com on this whole report. Are they trying to blame this on so-called Al-Qaeda, web terrorists, some sort of biological terrorists, when it's the laboratories themselves that are either letting this out by accident or by human intention, and whether this was some sort of a biological experiment in South Korea that might be used as a biological weapon against North Korea, or whatever, why is the rest of the world being warned of this? Obviously, a biological terrorist would have to be a psychotic, because if he was trying to get at some enemy, viruses are indiscriminate. They'll just sweep the globe and wipe out millions regardless of what homeland you're from. So it would come back to bite your own people. This would not make any sense for a terrorist with any political cause of any kind. So
hold that thought there for just a moment as we bring our stations online. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Bill Sardi, and we're talking about this unusual situation where apparently in Korea they'd found this created virus. It was actually dates back to the 1930s, but of course very, very specifically found in a pig there. So what was a human virus doing in a pig? Ordinarily, pigs would not be infected with human viruses, unless, of course, it's some sort of a genetic manipulation where they have actually found how they can infect animals with human viruses, and they know how to make animal viruses infect human beings. They've been working on these things for a long time. And so Bill is raising the question, what really was behind this? Could it be possible that this was accidental? Could it be possible it was intentional? Pick up the story from there, Bill.
Well, we do begin to wonder whether this is going to just fizzle out like the SARS virus that happened 2 years ago. There was great concern about it. It didn't really, I believe about 812 people all total died from it. The SARS virus, patient zero for the SARS virus, if you want to look it up on the internet very carefully, end up to be a professor working on viral strains in China. He went to a wedding in Hong Kong from Guangzhou, and he, on the way to the wedding, apparently spread this virus. So the point we're making here is it came out of a laboratory. And if something is going to sweep the world as a pandemic in a strain of flu of which none of us are prepared to have any immunity against, it's most likely going to come out of a laboratory. It's very doubtful. It looks like they're using Al-Qaeda or biological terrorists as the scapegoats here, either for the laboratory errors or for their own devious plans of controlling the world population. I hate to be a sensationalist. I certainly don't want to be a conspiracy theorist every time I wake up and look over my shoulder and wonder about these things. But you see, the World Health Organization is recently put out a bulletin saying that the world population is too big. It says that it's going to hit 9 billion in the year 2050. Most of it's going to be in the third world. It's going to grow from 6 to 9 billion in a few short years. And, of course, it's the same World Health Organization responsible for control of disease, vaccines, viruses, population planning, birth control, and one other thing. It's the United Nations through the World Health Organization that is will meet this summer to put numbers on rules called Codex Alimentarius to limit the amount of vitamins and nutrients in dietary supplements, vitamins and minerals. It's those same vitamins and minerals that give us the immunity from disease. We'll explain that further in just a moment. But why, you see, all in one organization, why would they be setting rules to limit the amount of nutrients in vitamin pills at the very time we may need them, and need them in order for us to build immunity against disease? Is this some sort of method? Is this some devious plan to cull down the populations of the world? We don't know, but we do know that the World Health Organization definitely has plans and goals to control the population of the world. And, of course, the Centers for Disease Control here, despite the fact they've been holding something called viral war games for a number of years and have spent hundreds of millions of dollars, says they're not prepared to prevent a viral influenza outbreak in this country or elsewhere.
Well, you know, I think the most important thing, Bill, is for our listeners to realize that your best protection against getting the influenza or any other disease, for that matter, is your immune response. And, you know, we can talk all about, oh, well, we've got to take this vaccine or that vaccine, and yet we know about the studies, Dr. Funderburg's studies, and he is certainly the dean of vaccinologists. You can get the material off his website, or we'll be glad to send you the abstract. We know if you were to have done what your doctor told you and taken your influenza shot, of say 3 to 4 of them in a 6-year period, in a 5-year period, and you were between 60 and 65, according to Dr. Funderburg, your chance of getting Alzheimer's disease would go up 1,000%. And he had studied this for, you know, 30 or 40 years. He's certainly one of the, he's in his 80s now, and he trained most of the immunologists who are in the world today. So he's warning the danger of taking influenza shots. More recently, studies have been released that show they didn't do a bit of good at all as far as stopping or in decreasing the morbidity among senior citizens. So now, of course, they're telling us, oh, well, we're going to have to come up with a vaccine in case there's a worldwide pandemic. And yet the most important thing, and the point that Bill is trying to make, is you've got to be able to build up your immune system. I personally had the chance to talk to Dr. Ken Alibak, who was the number 2 man in the Soviet biowarfare agency in Russia. He eventually defected to America. And although I couldn't get him to come on my program, we did talk. And he said, you know, there's no way we can possibly immunize people against all the bacteriological and viral diseases that would be used in biological warfare. He said, I had to take immunizations for 50 or 52 different diseases. He said, I'm allergic to just about everything, and if we do that to people, it will simply kill them. And his suggestion was, we need to find ways to build up people's immune system. And this is exactly what Bill's talking about. So why don't you pick up the story from there, Bill?
Well, Dr. Henry Nyman, who found this gene sequencing for this mutated human flu virus, inserted in a pig and then put on this database at Los Alamos, New Mexico, in a World Health Organization data bank. This is run by the United Nations. These are all linked together. And, of course, he's greatly concerned, and he wants to know why the action hasn't been taken to remove these pigs, in other words, kill them all, in order to get rid of this, if this is actually a mutated virus. He wants to know why immediate action hasn't been taken. more than 3 months have gone by now with no action. So there's question here. Of course, there's the issues of authority because you're dealing with a different country, South Korea. But why is the Centers for Disease Control constantly warning against a extremely concerned, says the headlines, and very ominous threat of the bird flu, say CDC officials, and yet what are we to do about it? Well, there's only 2 million vaccine doses that are going to be prepared for the H5N1 bird flu virus. That's not enough for most of the world, let alone the United States. Britain has bought two antiviral drugs, but they don't work very well. They really just handle the symptoms. They don't do very well at preventing infection from person to person. And one of the other drugs they want to use, amantadine, is something that makes you dizzy, can cause all kinds of other side effects, lightheadedness, fainting, confusion. You couldn't give it to our airplane pilots, our police officers, our military people. And it has a drawback, amantadine, that induces a change in the flu virus so that it becomes resistant to the drug in the first place. So then you have a worse strain of the flu. And so for everyone listening, biologists of the world have been trained under Darwinian biology, a godless theory, that survival of the fittest, that if you see the populations of the world were controlled in the past by plagues, and now that the population of the world is growing by leaps and bounds, that maybe the idea is to reintroduce some of these plagues and let the survival of the fittest, let it happen. And so, of course, who's the most fit is the people that have the greatest nutrition. Even in the flu virus of 1918, that killed 50 million people worldwide, they make this sound bigger because it was only a few hundred thousand in the United States because we had even pure food and clean. We hadn't even fortified our food with vitamins at that time we have now. So it's those people who have the least nutrition that are going to be most vulnerable to this, and particularly the very, very young, the small infants. They have 6 to 8 colds a year just because of it until their immune system is developed, and then the very old whose immune system is worn out. And of course, we know that we need vitamin C and E as vitamins. We need zinc and selenium as minerals for our immune system. But to show you and try to reveal to you just exactly where all this is coming from is we now have unequivocal evidence that if we have enough selenium, if we're not deficient in that trace mineral, that then viruses will not be able to mutate in our body and become the most virulent forms, and in particular the influenza viruses, whether they're mutated strains or not. And we may get a mild case of the flu, but it won't cause the lung damage, scarring, and then, of course, the mortality. Now, immediately with this evidence, the World Health Organization and the CDC should be calling for the entire world to fortify their foods with selenium, which would wipe out every year. A few hundred thousand people die of influenza viruses every year anyway, and this would quell the whole thing. No, they're trying to push for more vaccines, more money for the drug companies, and they're going to allow this pandemic to happen if it does occur. And it may be man-made. It may not be naturally occurring, though they seem to want to try and blame it on jumping from animals to humans through some mutative process. It looks like it's being engineered rather than anything out of nature.
And, of course, one of the most frightening things to me is the fact that why we sent people up into the tundra to dig up from the permafrost. Some of the people who died of this epidemic back in the 1918 period, so we could get our hands on the virus. Why would you want to do something like that? You'd think you'd want to have that virus gone forever. No, they had to get in the laboratories. And what happens if it gets out of the laboratories? Oh, I suppose it'll just be a terrible, terrible tragedy, but we'd never do anything like that intentionally, would we? We'll be back in just a moment here with our Bill Sardi. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Bill Sarley, and we're just talking about this very real problem of we're being told over and over and over again of the danger of the recurrence of this flu influenza pandemic. And remember, whenever they begin to focus our attention on an issue, it's being done with a specific purpose. And whenever day after day and week after week and month after month, we see articles in the news magazines and the newspapers, and we hear it discussed on the radio, and we hear it discussed on television, we know that we're being propagandized to influence our response and control our reactions and to, of course, simply to besiege us with fear. So pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, certainly we are alarmed from our side now hearing all this and putting it all together. And it does seem surrealistic, and it does seem like, well, we should be concerned, and certainly for our loved ones and anybody around the globe, and concerned for all of humanity, God's children, with some sort of possibility that certainly those who are the least well-fed, the least who nutrient status, of course, will be more vulnerable to all this. Now, it's very interesting, as I say, it all comes at a time where they're going to restrict the amount of these very minerals and vitamins that we can put into a vitamin pill. This has already occurred in Germany, where they've limited the amount of vitamin C to 225 milligrams. You can't even find a vitamin C pill anymore in the United States under 500 milligrams. Zinc tablets cost $6. To buy a bottle here in the United States. It's $43 now in the Scandinavian countries because of all this. And this is coming here. This is what they're bringing here with the World Health Organization and the United Nations-driven Codex Alimentarius to limit the amount of vitamins and minerals. And I'm predicting a coming black market in dietary supplements. People, once they become educated and get over nutriphobia, stop listening to the government about recommended dietary allowances, which are paltry doses, and understand that we need more than that to remain healthy. And once we get over that, we'll understand that we need these doses of nutrients, and we need them at home. Governments are never going to be able to deliver vaccines, medicines, or whatever in a timely way. If millions need something all at one time, there's no way that your family would be protected. So I'm predicting a coming black market in dietary supplements. You can go to get your pencils out because I'm going to give you some places to run to. If you want to read about my report, who inserted the mutated human influenza virus in a pig in South Korea and how to prepare for the upcoming influenza pandemic, go to my website at askbillsardi.com. You can read the whole story there. By the way, there's no commercials there whatsoever. Just a report for you to read. And if you'd like to read about the coming black market in dietary supplements, we made a special little website, globalvitamintakeover.com. You can read all about it at globalvitamintakeover.com, and you can just read that whole story. It's a little too political for my standard health website, so we decided to create another little web page for it. But in response to all this, I don't want to leave everybody hanging. What do we do to prepare for this? Well, certainly vitamin C, selenium, as I previously mentioned. There's some wonderful things even for our children, like elderberry syrup, which has been shown in two wonderful studies to calm down, reduce the symptoms of any influenza virus and cut the duration. There are things we can do.
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest this evening is Bill Sarley, and of course he was just talking about, if you'd like to get more information about this whole idea of this virus, this human virus now, this genetically engineered human virus that's been found in a pig, you can go to his website, and that's askbillsarley.com. If you'd like to know more about the coming black market in pharmaceuticals, because the government in their wisdom is going to begin to restrict the amount you can get and cut back on the amount of vitamin C and vitamin E and the other things you can get in your capsules, why the article on the coming black market in the vitamins, what's the website they go to for that?
Globalvitamintakeover.com, globalvitamintakeover.com. And, of course, we're just trying to educate you all. We're not trying to put you in a state of fear, but we should be concerned, and we should be ready at any time for any kind of, as it goes, a few thousand people die of the flu every year, usually the very old and the very young. And this may be all unnecessary. Certainly if we learn this new information about selenium, it certainly would wake all of us up to having greater immunity just through a simple trace mineral. So these are all important lessons for us to learn. Now, we are concerned about our Christian population around the world, serving as missionaries or anywhere else. And we began to wonder about people who certainly want to know what to do. And so if you go to globalvitamintakeover.com, or you can go directly to another little website called survivalvitamins.com. And what we've done for you there is we have an 11-page, a free 11-page guide to explain all this, which dietary supplements do you need to protect from infectious disease, protect from viruses, to protect from all kinds of issues, health challenges that you might have, and which dietary supplements are going to be the best at reducing the risk of mortality. Vitamin C is at the top of the list. Fish oil is number two, and it goes on down. We prioritize it for you. And then we do one more thing. On the list, we tell you, look, go out and buy these simple nutrients, stock your home up, make sure you have plenty of this. And if you're buying this in bulk powders and liquids, the government has no control over the dosages. They can't control this in pills. And so what we've done is we went and looked, tried to find the best sources of all this, the highest quality, and there is a source there at survivalvitamins.com, and you'll be remarked at all of this. We had a hard time believing it ourselves. We can provide every human being 2,500 milligrams of high-quality, hypoallergenic vitamin C powder for $1.80 a month. $1.80. You can't buy any better vitamin C than this. We know nutrition. If you want fish oil, the number two dietary supplement for everyone in your family, this is for your nervous system, certainly for your immune system, helps people with arthritis and so on. Everybody ought to be on fish oil. Helps with a cardiovascular program. Instead of taking aspirin, this thins the blood and prevents the blood clots in your coronary arteries. Fish oil, the highest grade you can find, molecularly distilled, high in DHA, $3 a month. We're doing this for our Christian crowd in particular, but anybody who's needy. We have homeschooling families. We have people that are retirees, and they just don't feel they can participate when we talk about things here on the air. So we're trying to find, if you want to shop for them on your own, please do, or you can use, already we've shopped for you, found no compromise in quality, and this is a commercial effort I'm involved in. I can't hide that part of it. But I'm trying to tell you is that we've found a way for everyone. With our guarantee, you can get vitamin C $1.80 a month, fish oil $3 a month, it goes on down the line, vitamin D $1.50 a month, folic acid $3.90 a month, and so on. All the nutrients you might need, unbelievably low high quality and low price, and we have the things like the elderberry syrup for the children and adults if they get the flu. We have some others like oil of oregano, now just found to be active against viruses as well as bacteria, in liquid, in very low price, high quality, all these kinds of things so you can stock your, and explains how to do this. Get your free 11-page guide, the vitamin survival nutrition guide. Just go to survivalvitamins.com, download it and print it out, and go anywhere you like to buy the vitamins. We don't care. What we're trying to do is arm the world with nutrition so we won't be vulnerable to these pandemics and what appears to be certainly a lapse in our own government in protecting the public.
And, of course, when they're going out to begin to restrict the amount of vitamins that you're going to be able to get, it's going to cost you twice as much. If you're going to get vitamin C, you're going to have to get three or four to five times as many capsules as you could be able to get today. We Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Bill Sardi. One of the more interesting things, I think, and certainly something I have learned, is that most animals actually produce their own vitamin C. And so they don't get a lot of the diseases, certainly at least. They have a great deal of immunity, and they have the immunity because their body produces vitamin C. And there are only really a few mammals that don't produce their own vitamin C. One is a bat of some sort, and one is a hamster, and then, of course, there's the human beings. For some reason, we have a genetic defect, but vitamin C is essential for so much in the body. It makes up the hyaluronic acid. It certainly is important in so many things and functions of our body. And so we're just not going to get enough of that in the diet. And so we need to take supplements of it. And this is one of the things that Linus Pauling stressed 30 years ago when he was demonized and he was attacked and vilified for suggesting that if you took large doses of vitamin C, why, you wouldn't tend to get colds. In fact, he believed if you took large doses of vitamin C, it would certainly keep you in many instances from getting heart attacks and other degenerative diseases involved in the cardiovascular system. So would you like to sort of pick up on that idea, Bill? Because I think it's so important people understand how vital vitamin C is to maintaining a healthy body and specifically healthy immunity.
Well, certainly the greatest thing for us to overcome, I want to encourage everyone in the audience to completely ignore the recommended dietary allowance. It's totally bogus, flawed, based on old science, and kind of watered down, so we would just be protected from frank deficiency diseases like scurvy, pellagra, beriberi, and so on. So we won't get the optimal doses that we need. When the animals make anywhere from the warm-blooded animals, anywhere from about 2,500 milligrams all the way up to 13,000 milligrams a day or more, then we know that we probably ought to be getting as much vitamin C. They make it through the day. We now have new research shows us that we ought to be taking vitamin C three or four times a day. We ought to be taking a full-sized adult at least 2,500 milligrams. We have a brand-new baby in our home who hasn't been vaccinated, 9 months old, with no colic, no rashes, and no viruses to date, and we give him 20 milligrams of vitamin C per pound of body weight. So this baby's getting 400 or 500 milligrams of vitamin C a day, which is equivalent to over 6,000 in a human being, so an adult. So the if you want healthy babies, you need vitamin C to build collagen to build your body.
Hold that for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Bill Sardi, and we were simply pointing out that the human being doesn't make vitamin C. Now, most animals do, and there are just a couple. One of them is a specific type of bat. Another one's a hamster. We don't make a vitamin C. Us hamsters. Us bats and us human beings, but everybody else does, and the animals produce a tremendous amount of vitamin C, and this is why, since we cannot manufacture it in our own bodies, why we need to be taking vitamin C supplement, which is so instrumental not only to our general health, but to our immune response. And this is what Linus Pauling was talking about, 30 years ago when he was demonized and attacked. But I think that history has proven that Linus Pauling was right and the medical establishment that attacked him so viciously was wrong. So we need to be able to get adequate doses of vitamin C, and if the government has their way, you're not going to do that because they're going to limit the amount of vitamin C in a capsule to about 250 milligrams, and of course you're going to have to take an awful lot of different capsules just of vitamin C to get an adequate amount. Why are they doing this sort of thing? Well, you have to ask yourself, is this stupidity on their part? Why are they interfering with our right to get the large dose vitamin C in capsules if we want to pay for it? Pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, certainly, you know, way back in the 1930s through the 1970s, Dr. Frederick Klenner in North Carolina was even treating polio with high dose vitamin C. Many of you don't know it, but there is a nasty little cough running around the United States. People think they got the flu, it hits the family. Now all of a sudden there's a lingering cough in the whole family, and they don't realize it's whooping cough. How do you treat it? High-dose vitamin C. It's going around the country. because the illegal immigrants from the southern border are bringing it across. And, of course, we now have hepatitis, and we have TB and skyrocketing rates of whooping cough. So believe me, if you get a cough that's unremitting, you might think that you have whooping cough. It's all the way up to the Canadian border by now, as we've heard from people up there. And, of course, people don't realize, don't run to the doctor. They just think they have a nasty, lingering cough and don't realize it's the whooping cough. So we need to find alternatives outside of antibiotics. Vitamin C in high doses might even work for us. It's certainly a good antiviral and antihistamine, anti-allergy. And, of course, we just need to take it through the day and learn how to do that because the animals are making it all day long. And you notice, have you ever seen an animal with a cold or a virus or whatever? They don't get them. So they're not vulnerable to these things in general until they get to old age. By then, their system isn't making the vitamin C that they made when they were younger. So we just need to learn some of these lessons. And, of course, it's critical and important for our health. We've been dumbed down. We've been made to be afraid. We have neutrophobia. We're more afraid of the dietary supplements and alleged side effects than we are medicines. We go right down and buy these anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, acetaminophen, and aspirin, all which could kill us and kill quite a few thousand people a year and never think twice about it, and yet we're scared away from vitamin C or beta-carotene or all these other little innocent dietary supplements. Why are we restricting the dosage of vitamins and minerals in pills, when what are we fixing? Where are the dead bodies? Where are the side effects they're talking about? There aren't any. There's another agenda afoot. It's real obvious. So we're making you aware of this. If you're on the inside of this like I am, where you study it every day, it gets a little frightening. You'll want to share it to everybody in a positive way. We're now overusing the antibiotics. I got a terrible phone call today from a man whose young son, now 5 years old, has epilepsy. And in looking through the health history of the boy, modern medicine now says they have no cure and no treatment for him outside of brain surgery. And what we find is overuse of antibiotics, and a little bug got in his digestive tract because they wiped out the good acid forming, the acidophilus, in his digestive tract that protects you. That's 70% of your immune system is in your digestive tract, and therefore another little bug got in there and took up residence, and now it's causing bizarre symptoms. Usually that's autism. In this case, it's epilepsy in this young boy. Now what we have to do is give some non-prescription antibiotics, is what we're recommending to the parents, like oil of oregano, like fresh crushed garlic, and so on. And then giving him good bacteria to put back in the boy's digestive tract. This is acidophilus and so on, and trying to help this young child. Modern medicine has no answers. We're overusing antibiotics. We now have, on the non-viral side, we have the bacteria, and now we have no defense against bacteria if we have this bacteria that's mutated, and now it's resistant to all of the antibiotics. So we have to learn how to use nature's antibiotics. There's no resistance to garlic ever shown ever in the laboratory dish, very little ever shown to oil of oregano and some of these other things that we can learn to use. I was talking about elderberry syrup. You want to buy all these very economically and arm your family and have health at home, then go to survivalvitamins.com, download the survival nutrition guide, and you can get a little priceless there on how to buy all this very economically or shop for it on your own. But simply arm your home with these things. Let's stop being so dependent upon government or doctoring or insurance companies. They're not going to help make us any healthier. And they certainly led us down the wrong track with the overuse of antibiotics, with the overuse of vaccines that have the mercury and so on in it. And now we find the headlines show that the flu vaccine hasn't even saved lives. The latest data released from the CDC, reluctantly released, shows that now they can't even show that the flu vaccination program has reduced the number of deaths in the United States over the last 20 or 30 years, even though they've kept these active vaccination programs going so that the pharmaceutical companies could make hundreds of millions of dollars.
And, of course, they have said that even though it doesn't work, we're going to continue giving it. What possible reason would be for that? Well, the most the thing that's increasing in the number of people who are dying of it is Alzheimer's disease. The incidence of death from cancer apparently dropped a little bit. The incidence of the death from degenerative arterial and cardiovascular disease dropped a bit. And the incidence of Alzheimer's disease rose 6% this last year. I wonder how many of those people got their Alzheimer's disease simply because they followed their doctor's advice and took their influenza shots, which I really am very, very much against. I have never taken an influenza shot. I don't believe in the influenza shot. And now we have the evidence there's a direct link to Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, be very, very careful. And it's not that your doctor wants to give you bad information. Believe me, he would never do anything intentionally to hurt you. But he's listening to what the CDC says. And remember, of course, the CDC was responsible for stopping the AIDS epidemic. 500,000 Americans are dead. Almost another million are infected today with this virus. And this is the end result of the CDC's refusal to do what was necessary to stop an epidemic that has killed over 500,000 people here in the United States. So don't rely upon the CDC. They're a political organization. There are many diseases which they will not address properly, such as the Gulf War illness, such as Lyme disease, such as chronic fatigue syndrome, and there are literally millions of people who are incapacitated by these diseases, and for one reason or another, they refuse to address them. You're going to have to look after your own health. Wouldn't you agree, Bill?
Well, certainly, and I think for everyone listening, so you know, that the drug companies have a number of drugs coming off patent this year to the tune of $36 billion of sales. The idea is to do what they're successfully doing in Britain, Germany, and the Scandinavian countries and elsewhere, and that is limit the dosage of vitamins and minerals in pills, make the higher doses prescriptions, and then make up for their lost profits by making them doctor-prescribed items. This is exactly what they're doing in Europe. It's coming here. I'm predicting a black market in the dietary supplements. I don't want to be an alarmist. It's just what's coming down. They are, of course, relentless in their pursuit of this. This has been going on for a number of years. You're going to be scared away from the high doses. All these things you read, a new study came out here just the other day showing that vitamin E may be increasing the risk of heart failure. How this could possibly, as the doctors look you straight in the eye and tell you vitamin E could possibly increase your risk of heart failure. In the study that we're talking about, they were prescribing other drugs like beta blockers that slow your heart rate down. It's a form of heart failure. They give you statin drugs to these same patients that reduces the energy to your heart muscle. And they give diuretics that depletes you of vitamin B1 thiamine, which then your heart loses energy and induces beriberi, heart failure. And with that in mind, with these other three drugs that induce heart failure, they blamed it all on vitamin E. It's unbelievable.
Well, what's that old saying? Figures don't lie, but liars figure. And there's a great deal of money to be made. And, you know, for those of you who haven't read Dr. David Graham's testimony before the Senate in November of last year, we'll be glad to make that available for you if you can't find it any other place. Dr. Graham was the assistant or the assistant director of drug safety. He had actually participated in getting 12 different drugs withdrawn from the market because they were killing people. And then they refused to do anything about Vioxx. So he got invited to testify before the Senate. And what he said was that in 1999, before Vioxx was released onto the market by Merck, why they had a study, it was called the 090 study, that showed with low-dose Vioxx, he had a 700% increase in the incidence of heart attacks. A 700% increase in heart attacks. So what did the FDA do? Why, of course, they did the logical thing. They released it on the market without warning. And then, of course, to get around that, they figured, well, what we'll do is we'll compare Vioxx with Celebrex, because we know that Celebrex increases heart attacks. So we'll compare Vioxx with Celebrex, and Vioxx won't look so bad. So they compared it with Celebrex. and with high doses, why they had, 350% more heart attacks. And with low doses, they had 150% more heart attacks with Vioxx and with Celebrex. And still, no warnings were given to the American people. Well, as you remember, of course, they withdrew it from the market. Then they put in a panel, and 10 people on that, the 30-member panel, actually had ties to the drug company. And when they took a vote, why, science is based upon fact, not upon a vote. But, with a vote, the vote with 10 people there tied to the drug industry was just enough so that they could put Vioxx back onto the market. And now they put it back onto the market and said, well, now that you know why there is a risk, why, of course, you can't very well sue Merck, because you intentionally are taking it. They passed legislation to stop lawsuits in the local courts. Now all lawsuits have to go to the federal courts. Now I think maybe the lawsuits against Merck can be continued, because when the people understand that they knew there was a 700% increase in the incidence of heart attacks with low-dose Vioxx. And according to Dr. Graham, between 89 and 139,000 Americans either had heart attacks or strokes related to Vioxx, and 30 to 40% of those died. And he said those are conservative figures. He quotes another doctor in his testimony who had written an article that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine saying 160,000 people had heart attacks or strokes. And a significant number of those died. But I bet you didn't read those figures in your newspaper. They've done everything to confuse us. And are you really going to trust them, those people in the government and the FDA and the CDC and the NIH, with your health? If you'd like a copy of Dr. Graham's testimony, go up on the Internet or give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Ask for Dr. Graham's testimony before the United States Senate. That, interestingly enough, the exact details and what I have told you, most of this was never brought out in the local newspaper or by Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly, the guardians of our health. Go ahead.
Well, certainly. Thank you for that wonderful description of the history of this and more the recent history. We now have 422,500 adverse event reports from pharmaceutical drugs every year. This is up by 14% in just 1 year. Prescription drugs are killing thousands, while we can't find one death from a multivitamin in the last 8 years. We can find only a few deaths attributed to some herbal supplements, which are no longer on the market. People keep coming back for more. Dr. Stan, we know your audience, and we talk to many of them. And they're on 7 or 8 drugs. Without hesitation, their doctor put them on them, or they went down to the drugstore and got them over the counter. And without hesitation, they take those, but they call me up and wonder if the fish oil or the vitamin E or the vitamin C is going to interfere with their drugs. These are essential nutrients, the drugs that interfere. They're so afraid to wean themselves away from these problematic drugs. Of course, Ralph Nader's Public Citizen saying 181 drugs are unsafe on the market. There is no such thing as FDA approved or FDA says it's safe. The FDA is a fraudulent organization. They've approved 181 drugs that are unsafe. Most of them are drugs you're using. What's the concern now is, as I'm reading the British Medical Journal, they're is a great concern within the pharmaceutical industry that not enough new drugs are being approved. They're frightened. They're concerned. It says concern is beginning to spread beyond the borders of the pharmaceutical industry. Faced with sparsely populated pipelines of new drugs, companies are beginning to shift research budgets into more aggressive marketing on television. These are worrying times. Oh, my gosh, we don't have enough drugs that are killing people.
Well,
it's a terrible problem.
Let's get your websites out just one more time. That's survivalvitamins.com, is that right?
Yes, survivalvitamins.com for the free 11-page guide on how to survive with dietary supplements, survivalvitamins.com. If you want to read the political end of it, globalvitamintakeover.com tells you about the upcoming black market and dietary supplements. You want to read about this, who inserted the human mutated influenza virus in a pig in South Korea. That's at my regular website, askbillsardi.com. And of course, we welcome you to all those places to learn. And of course, if you weren't listening at the top of the hour, we've even found ways so that you can buy vitamin C at $1.80 a month and fish oil at $3 a month. You can't believe this. They're high grade. Just look into it yourself. But we are concerned about the health of our whole Christian family, the whole world, all of our loved ones, and we want you to be armed with good nutrition, certainly before any pandemic ever circles the globe.
And I'll tell you what, of course, if we really start getting a pandemic, you're not going to be able to get these items. Certainly, there's so many things that you can take to fortify and increase your immune response. That is the major thing that you can do to protect yourself and to protect your family. And you should be taking them all the time anyway. But, boy, if we ever did get into a major epidemic, why, you might find a real problem getting these things. So it doesn't do any harm to have a few these things on hand ahead of time. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Bill Sardi. Bill, we've got about 3 minutes. What's the message you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I believe that regardless of the sensationalism or however we're being misled in the news media or whatever, we always need to concentrate on having health at home. No health insurance program is going to make you healthy. And certainly we know that dietary supplements, if you'll just get over the nutriphobia and the misinformation, you'll learn that it works for you. I have not been sick in 12 years. I am a 60-year-old man who's just fathered our first child in my marriage, and I'm very happy to say that. I can tell you this stuff works. And I certainly want all this to happen to you, too. And I hear from suffering people all the time. And if you get a hold of me on my website, I'm happy to answer any health questions without any charge or obligation whatsoever. We're just trying to help people sort all this out for their own health. And I'm hoping that everyone finds a way to support Radio Liberty so we can keep this information coming to your home. And let's get armed and be aware and be prepared and practice good health in our homes. I hear so many families are sick all the time, and they don't need to be. And once you learn, people calling me up say, you know, this works. I used to be sick every year, and now I'm not. So I hope that starts to happen for you. And be aware as you get older or you have little babies at home, they're the most vulnerable. So, and remember, Dr. Stan is a physician, and he's advocating that you practice good health at home. And so this is why we follow along with the details of reports and why we support Radio Liberty as well.
Well, I appreciate that, Bill, and I really do believe that we have to look after our health, and there are ways to increase your immune response. Certainly Ken Allaback, I talked earlier about, you know, the number two man in the Soviet biowarfare division who defected to the United States. It reinforced what you had said, and certainly we mentioned that earlier, but I think it's so important that people understand that people who really know about what's going on in the world are talking about the major thing to do is increase your own immune response. Don't depend upon somebody else. Your body is a wonderful thing. It's fearfully and wonderfully made. And, of course, if we take care of it, if we know how to build up our immune response, in most instances, why, we're going to be able to fend off these terrible, terrible diseases. Everybody's out there taking their influenza shot, and everybody's coming down with influenza. The people who don't take the influenza shot, well, I have never taken an influenza shot. I have no intention of taking one, and I can't remember when the last time I had a bout of the flu. Bill Sardi, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Good night, Dr. Stan.
Good night, and thank you so much for being with us again. And we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we need to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will feel that the information you're going to get here is worthwhile enough that you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And if you feel that way, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a free copy of some of our newsletters, my last November newsletter dealing with the fact that the fluoride, the water fluoridation program we have across America, is poisoning our children why, give me a call. We'll be glad to send you a copy of the November newsletter. The December newsletter is a testimony by Dr. William Hersey, who is, of course, involved with testing drinking water for the Environmental Protection Agency. He is the vice president of the union of the physicians who work for the EPA, who've been trying for years to reach the people and let them know they're being poisoned with water fluoridation, because they don't just put fluoride in the water. They add a little arsenic, a little lead, a little cadmium, a little polonium 20. This substance is so toxic, why it's too expensive for the aluminum industry and the fertilizer industry to put in a toxic dump site. It would be too expensive. So they've sold the American people on the idea we want to put it in the drinking water. And we have all sorts of studies, scientific studies, that show the harm that it's doing. I had a woman on, an obstetrician gynecologist. It was just yesterday. Her name was Dr. Cindy Schneider, practices in Phoenix. And two of her children became autistic after they got their immunizations, after they got their childhood immunizations. And so she, of course, has left her practice and does full-time treatment of autistic children. And she's able to help a lot of them. But her remark to me was, we poisoned a whole generation of our children. And I really believe that. We poisoned them with fluoride and fluoride in the water and fluoride in the toothpaste and fluoride that you get in your soft drinks and you get on your vegetables, because we're spraying these things. Plants are too smart to pick up fluoride through their roots, so we spray it on the outside, and then, because we, of course, couldn't use DDT because that's too dangerous, so we put a deadly poison on your vegetables so that they'll grow without, of course, being infected by the various insects out there. And then, of course, we're poisoning our children with immunizations, with the aluminum and with the mercury that's in the childhood vaccines. And they tell us they've taken it out, but people who've tested them say that there's still traces of mercury in the vaccines, and there's the aluminum there. And you know what aluminum does to the brain, don't you? And then, of course, the aspartame, and then there's so many other things we're doing to harm the health of our children. Is anybody out there listening? You need to get Dr. Russell Blaylock's excellent book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, that touches on fluoride and mercury and aspartame and immunizations. And then, of course, you need, of course, to get the 4-tape sets we have on fluoride and on mercury and on aspartame, and the videos we have that we have with them, and the books we have on several of those subjects. You need to get the information you're not going to get from other sources. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Let me suggest my latest video. It's called None Dare Call It Genocide. That's None Dare Call It Genocide. It will give you an excellent overview of what is going on today and the harm that is intentionally being done to the health of our citizens, but even worse, the harm that is being done to our children. For as Dr. Cindy Schneider said the other day, just yesterday, we poisoned a whole generation of the youth of our country. And that's unconscionable. And the fact that you're not hearing about it, and nobody ever asked why our students do so poorly, why our students graduating from high school today can't compete with students from elsewhere in the world. And I'd like to suggest it's not simply because we have a terrible educational system, but we do. But there are other causes as well. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty. And till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. And of course, we're bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station we're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us, hopefully on the line, Ellen Gunderson-Traylor. Ellen, are you there?
I am here.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us tonight. And Ellen is certainly one of my favorite authors, and she's written a number of books on John, Son of Thunder, and Jerusalem, and the priest, and the oracle, and Mary Magdalene, and we've read an awful lot of them. My wife has read every book she's ever written. How many books have you written, really, that go approach things from a biblical point of view or from a biblical historical point of view?
17
books, and she's been published by some of the biggest publishers and Christian publishers in the country. At the present time, of course, she's publishing her own books, but she has that wonderful gift of being able to research and then write books on a specific subject. It's a gift that only a very, very few people really have, to come up with something that will just hold the reader transfixed. And I will tell you that if you haven't read Ellen Gunderson-Traylor's books, you've missed something. Now, we carry a number of them through our ministry because we think they're important, but we're going to be talking about a new book tonight, and this is a book that is quite different than anything I've read of hers before. It's on Gabriel, and it's about the battle that occurred in heaven before the earth was formed. And, you know, of course, as I read the book, and I noticed you referred to Milton, so then I had to go up and read about Milton's Paradise Lost, and then, of course, all the other books that have been written about this, the eternal question: why would a loving God allow evil in the world? And so, certainly Milton wrote about that, and Dante wrote about it, and C.S. Lewis wrote about this. But Ellen has written a fascinating story that I think that, everybody would read. And, well, why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, this is the first in a series which I am planning on writing. But this is Gabriel, the War in Heaven. And, of course, it's book one of the series, and the series is called Gabriel, God's Heroes. So I chose one archangel to follow the story of redemption through his eyes. And it's a way of telling the story of God's plan being worked out in human history. And, of course, before human history also, and showing it through the eyes of a select group of individuals, in this case the archangels. So the first book, of course, has to deal with what happened before the earth was created. How did it all come about that Lucifer ended up to be the prince of this world, and what led up to that? And there are wonderful hints in the scriptures about that, but like all of my books, I tried to flesh it out, so to speak, by bringing my own imagination to the story. And of course, this story is highly imaginative, because not one of us was there.
No, I don't know anybody who was there. But, of course, this is a book about what was going on in the world, going on in the universe before the earth was created or inhabited by human beings. Mm-hmm. And this battle that went on in heaven that we hear of this, we read about this in the scriptures, but most people don't understand it. We'll be back in just a moment. Our guest, Ellen Gunderson-Traylor. Well, this is Dr. Stan. And Ellen, how did you happen to write the book? Because it's so different than the other books that you've written. What motivated you to want to write a book about a time that most of us cannot even imagine, the time that existed sometime in the distant past, you know, when there was no earth, there were no people here on earth, and the earth really had not yet been created by God. And but yet, of course, you have this angelic situation that exists there, and then suddenly we begin to find that there is trouble in paradise. In fact, isn't that sort of the idea of Milton's Paradise Lost?
Exactly. Of course, he talks about the Garden of Eden, which I will go into in my second installment in this series. That book will be called The Grand Experiment. But this deals more with the war in heaven before the earth was created, and Milton, of course, deals with that too. But this is specifically about that, whereas Milton talked about Adam and Eve, and I'm leaving that for the second part. But what I'm really glad you asked me what intrigued me to write this story, because it's a highly personal thing for me. As you know, the last book I wrote was the second in the David Rothmeyer series, The Priest and the Oracle.
And I'm still waiting for the third book in that series.
And everybody is, and I need to explain what came about that prevented me or kind of interfered with my finishing it, and that relates directly to this book that we're talking about. A couple of things happened there. I was into writing that third installment when the 9/11 attack happened. The Oracle came out in 2000, and as we all remember, the 9/11 attack was toward the end of 2001. But in the meanwhile, between the Oracle coming out and the 9/11 attack, I was into the third scenario with David Rothmeyer and the gang. But in that interlude period there, Dr. Stan, my father passed away. And my dad, Dr. Herbert Gunderson, was so incredibly important in my life. I mean, I know everybody's father is important to them, but my dad had such a profound impact on my life and in forming my interest in scripture and in history. And my dad was quite a professor.
Hold that thought right there.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Helen Gunderson-Traylor, who's one of my favorite authors. And if you've ever read her books, and we carry so many of them, whether it be Mary Magdalene or John, Son of Thunder, or Melchizedek, isn't it? Yeah, I've got a book on him. And then, of course, on Jerusalem and the priest and the oracle, which is sort of a biblically based story, but it's a sort of almost like an Indiana Jones type of adventure story. Fast moving, the priest, the oracle, of course it all has to do with the coming prophetic things that are occurring over in the Holy Land, the fact that of course the Jews are waiting for the return of the Messiah, of their Messiah. We're waiting of course for the return of our Messiah, and of course the two are quite are really not the same at all. They're believing that their leader is going to come and rule the world, and we believe our leader is going to come and rule the world, but they're not the same entity, I fear. So anyway, that is the background. Ellen was telling us she had written The Priest, she had written The Oracle. They were exciting stories, adventure stories, and she was working on the third in the series, and believe me, if you ever read any of these at all, you'd want to hear the third one, or read the third one. And then her father, Dr. Gunderson, had died, and as she was working on the third volume, and then what happened, Ellen?
Well, as I was saying, it's hard to express how important he was to me, and the fact that he was such a powerful Christian man is all woven into that. He was a professor and the head of a department at a university and had been a Bible professor and so forth. But when my dad passed away, it turned my mind to heavenly things, and I just was craving to know what he might be experiencing, what heaven might be like, and I just couldn't get it out of my mind, and this went on for a long, long time, and during that period is when I really began to think about the whole essence of heaven and the angels and what they might be like, and I read everything I could get my hands on related to angels, scripturally, personal experiences and so forth, of people from St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Paul all the way up to modern times. And anyway, out of this came Gabriel the War in Heaven. Then, while I was writing that, comes 9/11. And so while I was thinking both in terms of David Rothmeyer's story and what was going on with the whole story of his search for the priest, the high priest of Israel and all of this with 9/11 came about, and I had to just really stop and analyze how this would affect my story of David Rothmeyer, because as you can imagine, it fit right in. You've read both the books, and you know, so it fit right in. So I just thought, well, as long as I'm into Gabriel, I'll just pursue that, and I'm going to let the others sit there for a while and let it sink in and see what happens here in the world. And now, of course, I'm ready to pick up and go on with that. But the Gabriel thing really grew out of my yearning to touch heaven and to know what heaven is really all about.
Do you ever have an experience when you start writing a book and it ends up differently than you anticipated, that it's not all planned out or it doesn't necessarily end up as you anticipated?
Well, you know, because most of my books deal with the historical facts or historical people, I do know basically how they're going to turn out because the story has already been told. But even within those stories, yes, characters will take on dimensions that I never anticipated. They will, it's like the characters begin to tell their own story, and I don't mean for that to sound spooky, but it just, they take on a life of their own, and it doesn't always turn out just the way you think. And then when you're writing books that are not of a historical nature, that have their own ending, which has never been told, yeah, they lead you down exciting avenues. It's a highly creative adventure, really, and only people who have actually done this kind of work would relate to what I'm saying. But I'm sure that artists and musicians and, you know, people who deal with the creative endeavors would all agree that your project will always take on its own life, and sometimes it leads you on a merry chase, and sometimes it takes you in directions you hadn't expected.
I really think that's so true. I know when I write my newsletters, I sometimes going to tell one story, and the newsletter leads me in an entirely different direction, and yet it always comes together. Sometimes I'm sure it's never going to, but it always does, and it usually, hopefully, has something worthwhile to say. Well, and now in your exciting story of Gabriel, the War in Heaven, why we have to ask the question, why would a loving, all-powerful God create a being that would go in revolt against him? And that, I think, is the question, you know, that has plagued philosophers that since the beginning of time and plagues us today. And I'm not sure we'll ever know the true answer to it, but, you know, certainly you have a very logical explanation. Do you want to sort of develop that idea of why God, a loving God, who could create everything perfect, would allow something, a being like Lucifer, who was really one of the most beautiful of all the angels, suddenly to turn against him?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's the same as with human beings. He gives us all the capacity to make our own choices. And that is one of the main themes of my story. You may recall the scene where God makes a big pronouncement in my book, from the throne room, that he is going to create a new thing, and he calls it choice. And the very concept of choice in my story, I have it being a new thing that never before had the angels really had a choice. They served God because they loved Him and they worshipped Him because they loved Him, but they'd never been really given any other choice. And now He's going to allow choice. And at first, that is an extremely frightening concept to the angels, and they don't even really understand what it means. And it just about brings down the gates of heaven when God makes this pronouncement, because they don't quite know how to deal with this, and it's very frightening to them. Well, of course, Lucifer, who, according to some of the passages in the Old Testament, had been with God almost from the beginning, and he's called the son of morning or the son of the dawn, and he was apparently the first angel ever created, and he was the closest of all of them to the Father and to the Son. And in fact, one of his functions in the throne room and in heaven was to go out when the Son, Jesus, Emmanuel, went out from the throne room. He would act as a covering over him. Now, we don't really know exactly what that means, and again, we have to, you know, interpret these things, and different people would see it differently, but apparently there's an allusion here to the Middle Eastern tradition of when a king went out from a throne room, there would be slaves or attendants who would go before him with large fans and kind of umbrellas and so forth, and they would shield him from the view of the public. So actually, this was how close Lucifer was to Emmanuel, to Christ. And so he was intimately bound to Jesus, and this is why so much more mystery comes in here as to why in the world he would ever revolt, because he had absolutely everything that he could want, but he didn't have the highest thing of all, which was the throne of God, and that's what he wanted. So, you know, the Bible doesn't explain it. It leaves it as a mystery, but there is a place in the scriptures where, you know, I believe it's in Ezekiel, where God says to Lucifer, "You were perfect. You were perfect until there was one thing found in you, and that was pride was found in you." So God knew that was in him all along, and in it, truly, he had choice built into him. All of us do, and at that point, it became full fledged then, and he rebelled.
And I think the thing that was so really powerful about your book, and it brought up this whole idea of choice, and you know, the battle that we fight today, it really is in our own minds. You know, this is where, of course, the dark forces come in, where we're tempted, where we get the idea of doing the wrong thing. But we always have to choose one side or the other. We have to choose following God or following, of course, our base instincts or the spirits that are telling us to do the wrong thing, to do what we want to do, not what God wants us to do.
Right.
And, of course, that famous saying that, you know, freedom is not the ability to do what you want to do. Freedom is the ability to do what you should do according to God's law. That is where freedom comes from. And, of course, when we turn from that, when we begin to do what we want to, when we make a choice, and we make the choice not to follow God's law, but to follow our own dictates, that's where, of course, where life begins to fall apart, and where marriages are destroyed, and where crimes are committed. And, of course, God's law is pretty simple. We only complicate it because we make the wrong choice. And a lot of that is pride, as Ellen says. We're going to be back here in a few minutes. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and I will tell you, this is an exciting book to read. The descriptions of the battle, the great battle that takes place in heaven, and the things that lead up to that, it's almost as if you're right there. And as always, Ellen, you, of course, paint these word pictures that give us this feeling of that we're experiencing exactly what you're writing about.
Oh, thank you.
Well, anyway, of course, you have a lot of pictures in here. Where did those pictures come from? You mentioned you took that. Did that come from Milton or where?
Yeah, well, this is the first book that I've been able to totally design myself from the ground up. And I had a lot of fun with it. You know, the illustrations in it, and I've never had a book with illustrations, but I found these pictures after I had written the book, Dr. Stan, and it just blew me away that there were these pictures that just fit so perfectly with what I had in mind.
And where did those pictures come from, though?
Well, they come from, they are various artists' renderings of scenes from Paradise Lost, from Milton's Paradise Lost. They are mostly out of the 1700s and 1800s, mostly French and English artists. And, you know, I had fun with my computer on this because there are some pictures where I actually did a little bit of manipulating of the content to fit the story just a little bit better. I could do that with these because they were public domain. I wouldn't be able to do that with things that were, you know, copyrighted. But anyway, it was just a really wonderful experience finding these pictures and then being able to use them in the text the way I did. I think they add quite a bit to the story. And then I had a lot of fun just designing the content, the actual way the pages look and the separation pages at the parts and the chapters and so forth. I think it's a really pretty book, frankly, if I do say so myself.
Where did that design come from that you use at the beginning of every chapter? It looks, well, it's got a very, very strange, you know, it's a sort of like a circle, but it's got a very strange configuration. Where did
it's
that come from?
It's supposed to be, well, I'm using it as Gabriel's shield, okay? That's supposed to be his shield. Actually, what that is that is a picture of a drum head. It's a leather drum, and I took it and I worked with the contrast on it and redid it so that it looks like a shield.
And of course, Gabriel was certainly there were four archangels.
Yes.
Now there were two. Of course, I recognized Gabriel and Michael. But what about this fellow? What was it, Ramon?
Uriel?
Or something? Yeah,
Uriel?
It almost sounds like a Mexican. Was this somebody who was in the Bible, or was this something that you'd sort of come up with?
Well, no, these are traditional names. These are ancient names, and they go way, way back in Jewish history. And there were apparently, and there are apparently, four archangels. There are allusions to the angels who are at the four corners. They hold the four winds. They hold the four corners of the earth and so forth. It is thought that Uriel is the name of the angel who held the flaming sword in the Garden of Eden so that Adam and Eve could not return.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is the Ellen Gunderson trailer, and if you haven't read her books, why, you've missed a great treat. And I was just thinking of some of the other books that I've read. I remember the one on Noah. Noah was really one of my favorites. And, of course, Mary Magdalene and John, Son of Thunder. And she's written 17 books, primarily biblical-based, although there are a couple of adventure stories in there that sort of like, The Priest and the Oracle, sort of almost like very, very similar to the Da Vinci Code, only, of course, not with, of course, all the false history and not intended upon destroying our belief in Jesus, our Savior. These, of course, only tend to increase our belief. But they're really great adventure stories, and yet they have a great deal to do with bringing to light the prophecies of the era in which we live. And so I recommend both The Priest and The Oracle, and I'm certainly waiting for the next version of this to come to pass. And I hope you just get that through before we get into World War III, which, of course, I really fear is coming. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But there have been back through the centuries, a number of people have written about heaven. They've written about hell. But Milton, when was he in the 1500s, 1600s, somewhere there?
Oh, now you're going to test me, boy.
I know is that he wrote 12, either 10 or 12 volumes.
I believe he was in the 1600s. Right. Now, you're going to get some professors calling in here to correct me, and I should know I have a master's in English. Isn't that awful?
No, you don't have to, because I had to go to the Internet today to look him up, you know.
But, what did you find there?
I found out that, of course, he was a prolific writer. This is one of the great poems of all time. Mm-hmm. It is an epic poem compared to Homer's writing or Virgil's writing. Mm-hmm. And here was a man who wanted to leave something for future generations, and he really has. And so many people have written about Paradise Lost, Milton's Paradise Lost, and C.S. Lewis has commented on it, and you can go up on the Internet, and there are all people there who are writing commentaries on this epic, which was written 300 or 400 years ago. Mm-hmm. And yet, of course, it had a tremendous impact upon Christian thinking. Pilgrim's Progress is the great Christian novel, and of course, Paradise Lost is a great Christian poem.
Well, you know, he wrote that all by dictation, too. He dictated that verbally to his daughters, who took it down like scribes. He did not handwrite that. He was blind. Milton was blind. And so all of this was in his mind, and he gave it orally. Can you imagine? It's just incredible. It really is a gift from the Lord. It really is. And there have been a lot of books based on Milton. I don't think of my book as being based on Milton, but it certainly coordinates with it. You know, to write about these things that nobody was around to see, it's an amazing adventure, and we all see similar things when we think about it, too. So it's that, you know, that's one thing I found very interesting, Dr. Stan, when I did the research for this book, because I read, probably a dozen books of collections of angel stories where people talk about their encounters with what they thought were angels, or angels rescuing them, or one thing and another, these modern day stories. And it was astonishing to me how similar the different aspects were. There were certain themes that ran through them that just repeated themselves over and over. And also people who claimed to have seen heaven, maybe in a near-death experience, or died and went to heaven and came back. Regardless of what you think of that, it's interesting how similar their experiences are, and what they say they see there is so interesting, because they are all so similar. And so I took a lot of that into consideration, and a lot of the scenes in my book, like the staircase leading up to the throne room and so forth, those are based on certain stories that I read along that line. And so there's something that runs deep down in us as human beings that repeats itself. It's a theme regarding our heavenly home. And it's a beautiful thing. And, you know, that's where we belong. We belong there. This isn't our home. Earth is not our home. Heaven should be our home. And how sad if we should miss it.
And, of course, I love your description of the heavenly choirs and the wonderful music that's there. And, you know, music is really has such a profound impact on our lives, on our very souls. But it has to be good music. And, of course, at one time, Lucifer was a great musician. But, of course, he's turned away from what was good to what is evil. And, you know, your descriptions of heaven almost made you feel like You're right there. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Helen Gunderson Traylor, author of 17 books, and certainly every one of these books is beautifully researched. Helen does a tremendous amount of job, reading what other people have written and reading the historical background before she ever undertakes to begin putting the story together. And the stories all come alive, and this is one reason I enjoy reading them. And, of course, this book, Gabriel, gives you a tremendous insight into what heaven may be. Now, admittedly, it's as Ellen sees it, based upon what she's been able to read, and you have to use your imagination in this, but it is an exciting book, because you begin to meet the angels, you begin to meet Michael, and he is the warrior angel, and of course then there's Gabriel, and then there's Lucifer. And what motivates Lucifer? I mean, what a magnificent creature he was, and yet, of course, once given choice, he made the wrong choice, and of course then he would energize other people to follow him along in revolt against God. And of course, I think this is the big problem in the world today: people in revolt against God. We all have a choice.
One thing that I had to think a lot about during writing this, and I'm sure the question has crossed everybody's mind at one time or another, is that, Lucifer was not given a second chance. When he failed, it was once for all, and he blew it. It was over. Human beings are given a chance to be redeemed, and that's, of course, why Christ died for us. But there was nothing like that offered to Lucifer or his followers, which was a third of the angels in heaven. Millions of angels followed him and were cast down to earth with him. Why? Why do you suppose, and I had to think about that, why Lucifer would not have been given a second chance, and we have been. And I do have a theory on that.
All right, what is it?
Well, Lucifer was not tempted. We were actually tempted to fall, and we were naive. We were innocent. We didn't really get the full picture, and God made an allowance for the fact that we were tempted and lured away, whereas Lucifer knew the whole story. He knew all of it. I mean, there was nothing to tempt him away except his own pride, and that is irredeemable. So
I think. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ellen was saying, she's really pondered this question, is why do you and I have a second chance? We're certainly, all of us have sinned and come short of the glory of God, but of course we're given a second chance because of the sacrifice of Jesus, but her point is that Lucifer didn't get a second chance because he was never tempted in the same way that we were. He knew what he was doing when he revolted against God. It wasn't simply that he was inadequate, he wasn't well informed. He knew exactly what he was doing. He made a conscious decision to try to thwart God and to take his place, and that was something God could not forgive him for. Would that be a fair statement?
I think so. And when Jesus was on the cross, he said, "Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing." Now, that doesn't mean that they were innocent in what they were doing, but they didn't have the full comprehension of what they were doing. And I think that, in all fairness, because we were duped, so to speak, and that's not to excuse us, but we were duped, God had to balance that out. In his economy, it would only be fair to balance that out with the chance for redemption. With the angels, the story was a different thing altogether. They were not duped. It's not as though they were ignorant of what they were doing in any way. They knew exactly what they were doing and chose to do it anyway. Now, that's the mystery to me. That's the part that is so mysterious to me, is why they would do such a thing when they did know exactly what they were doing. And I don't think that we really can answer that as human beings.
Well, you talk in your book about the mystery of iniquity, which is, of course, described in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
What is the mystery of iniquity? Is this the same thing that the point you're raising?
Yes, I think that's it. Is that it is something that is unanswerable, at least for us. I mean, in time, when we get to heaven, maybe we'll understand. But we don't comprehend the iniquity of Satan, and we don't understand his why he would do what he did. The origins of sin is a mystery. It is a great mystery, which human beings really can't comprehend. That's the mystery of iniquity.
And of course, the thing is that there's certain things that we will never understand, as mere mortals. And of course, people have argued back and forth. Theological texts have been written of why God, a perfect God, a loving God, would allow sin and evil in the world. And certainly, certain philosophies, the Zoroastrians, believe that God has two sides, one good and one evil. And of course, there are other theologians who believe, of course, that this evil is a specific entity. In fact, there is a triumvirate of evil, just as there is a Father and a Son and a Holy Ghost, a triumvirate of good. So there is a trinity of evil, Satan, the Antichrist, and the false prophet. So, I think that this certainly helps me, at least, to understand that there is this constant conflict. Everything within the dark side is a mirror image of Christianity. And, of course, right. When you study the occult, you find that the occultists really believe in the Bible. They just want to interpret it differently, and they want to defeat God. They really do, and the people here on Earth, believe that somehow, in some way, by serving Lucifer, they're going to defeat God, because it's intense hatred of God. It's hard, I think, for any of us to accept that, but this is the reality of what's going on today. But you've done a good job, I think, in your book, of explaining why it was that Lucifer, and I won't want to destroy that for the people who are going to be reading your book, but why it was that Lucifer decided that he was going to challenge God for supremacy. And I think that is something you bring out really very well. The question is, why did he do it, and why? I'm not going to let people know. But if anybody would like to, out there in the listening audience, would like to call and ask Ellen about this fascinating book, Gabriel, The War in Heaven, and we will be carrying that book. How much does it retail for?
$16.99.
Right, well, it's a fascinating read. It gives you almost that feeling that you're right there in heaven with Gabriel and with Michael and with the other archangels. Our telephone number, if you'd like to give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. I think we're going to go ahead and carry the book. I want you to know it's certainly nobody was there. This is Ellen's interpretation of what she thinks took place. But it's fascinating. And I think the major impact it had on me was thinking about heaven, what heaven must have been like before the fall, and what heaven would still be like today, of course, because the Lucifer and the angels have been cast down from heaven. And they're, as they say, they ain't going back again. They're not going back again.
What may I ask you a couple of things about what you thought of a couple of themes in the book?
Sure, you can.
A couple of them. Well, first of all, I have animals in heaven,
and I love that.
Good.
I would love to think there are going to be dogs in heaven and horses in heaven, because these are wonderful creations. Okay. And the affection, the relationship between an animal and a human being is something very, very special. And my wife has always said that she doesn't think she really worries about going there if there are not going to be any dogs, and she really would like to see the dogs that we've had here on this earth again. Sure. I don't know whether whether we ever will again, but, and we don't know whether there are any animals in heaven, but I thought it was a nice point. It was, and the fact that, you know, another thing that people would eat in heaven. They don't have to eat in heaven.
That was another one, uh-huh.
But, you know, I think the fact that we, eating is something that we not only do because we have to survive, but because we enjoy it.
Right.
And so there are many, you made heaven look so desirable.
And another thing was that people will work in heaven. I mean, that's what I have happening anyway, is that, you know, I have the angels having occupations, and I have warrior angels, I have carpenter angels, I have, you know, all musician angels, teacher angels, and I don't know, to me it just seems like what we enjoy here on earth is only just a shadow of what we should enjoy in heaven, and if we're fortunate enough to enjoy our work here on earth, wouldn't we want to continue something like that in heaven?
You know, I could not imagine anything worse in life than not having to work. In other words, we see some of these people fabulously wealthy. Mm-hmm. Or maybe probably most of them have inherited their wealth, and they really have very little to work for. Mm-hmm. They don't need anything at all, and so they try to find something to give life meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, so many of them find the wrong sorts of things, and they're involved in so many of the things that I talk about here on my programs, you know, about being involved in trying to transform the world. And, of course, I think many of them, of course, have given their lives over to the dark side, whether they know it or not. They're working to create this new world order and, of course, the new world religion, because so many of them have repudiated God. And that's really the problem. I think we have so many people here on earth that are educated far beyond their intelligence. I think the biblical story is a very simple one, but I believe it's true.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we were given work to do in the garden even before the fall. Adam and Eve worked in the garden. It's just that after the fall, work required strenuous effort that caused them to sweat and get tired and sore, but that was the curse, not the work itself. So these are all things that I had to think about, Dr. Stan, when I was writing the book. What are we going to do in heaven? You know, what do the angels do in heaven? We certainly don't sit around on clouds and play harps. I mean, where that idea ever came from, I can't imagine. I can't imagine anything worse than that. But, you know, we'll be active. That we are, people are active in heaven. People who've gone on to heaven, they're active, they're doing things, they're involved. The Bible says that they even, we have a cloud of witnesses around us watching what we're doing and cheering us on, you know? So I don't know what all that means exactly, but I know that heaven is not a place where we just retire. It's a place of more enjoyment and fulfillment and activity than we could ever imagine now.
I think that's very true, and I loved your description of the music in heaven, and I mentioned that earlier, but, you know, music is really such a wonderful thing, you know, if it's good music, if it's wholesome music, the phrase would be, if it's heavenly music.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you had whole, choirs in it, not only on, all throughout the universe.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, part of that comes from C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy. I don't know if you've read that, but in the Space Trilogy, they visit different planets. This scientist goes to different planets, and he discovers that there is music in the planets, and that the planets, the beings on other planets, is what he's subscribing to here, actually are looking in on what's going on Earth, and they are very deeply concerned about what's going on here. Now, I'm not talking about these wicked UFO creatures or whatever, but the heavenly spheres, the music of the universe. And the Bible says that the angels of the universe looked at the story of redemption and watched it as it was happening, and they were marveling at it and going, wow, this is phenomenal. What does all this mean? You know, they were intrigued by it. And so we're surrounded all around us. We can't see it. We don't comprehend it. But there's a whole world there, many, many dimensions of worlds around us that's very involved in what's going on in our lives and in the story of redemption.
I think you're absolutely right. And, of course, of course, I very often will be in touch with people who come from the dark side. And I've told this story before, but about this one witch who wrote to me, and she was furious. I'd done a television it's really one of the strangest networks out there, on a program called Unscrewed. We did a five-minute segment, and I will tell you, I couldn't watch that television program, but apparently there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of young people who are fascinated by the material on there. But anyway, this witch wrote to me, and she was furious with me because I had made talking about Luciferianism, and I'd mentioned witchcraft, and of course I was not intentionally suggesting that the witches were Luciferians. In fact, I'm sure many of them don't even believe in Satan. But, you know, she was writing to me, and she said, you know, we're good witches, we do nice things, we don't hurt people, and all we do is we come up with spells so we can contact beings from another dimension. Mm-hmm. And she's very, very sincere. Mm-hmm. And they do contact beings from another dimension.
Sure.
There is another dimension there.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not a dimension that I would want to contact, and I don't want anything to do with those beings because I believe those are truly demonic spirits or fallen angels that they're contacting. But there is a supernatural element out there. And the great tragedy is that the average American doesn't know that. Of course, there is a demonic dimension, but there is also an angelic dimension. Mm-hmm. And they're all in the same dimension, and we don't recognize it, but there is that battle going on here on Earth for the souls of men.
Well, that's what I was just going to point out, is that the war in heaven continued on Earth. The war in heaven did not end when Lucifer was cast out. It has continued on Earth, and now our plane here of the earthly plane is where this continues to be enacted until the end of time. And so we human beings are just a part of, and actually sometimes pawns in, this ongoing game between the forces of good and evil. You know, there's a story in the Bible about how, I believe it was Daniel, wasn't it, who was praying for intervention, and finally the angel Michael showed up and said, "I'm sorry I'm late, but I was detained by the angel of Persia, and he fought with me, and I had to fight him, and it held me up." So, you know, this goes on. Paul talks about principalities and powers in an ongoing struggle that we can't see.
Yes.
So, another thing that I've had to think about is that angels are not all powerful. They have their limitations, and this limitation is involved with the fight that goes on, the fight between good and evil. God, of course, is all powerful, but these intermediaries, so to speak, the angelic forces are in this struggle that goes on. So I don't know all about that, and I'm still thinking about that and trying to work that out in my mind. But apparently, you know, angels don't just jump at our every whim. When we pray for help, it's not instantaneous.
No, and of course, there are other forces that are trying to lure us away from
exactly
doing what is right. And this I think, is the most significant thing, that if you give in to it, why, there are those demonic forces that are trying to draw you away from God. In fact, this battle goes on in our mind every day.
Mm-hmm.
Which side do we choose? Do we choose God? Or do we choose what we want to do? Because that's exactly what Lucifer was doing. He was making choice that he was going to do things his own way.
Right.
He wasn't going to love God. He wasn't going to obey God. He was going to challenge God. And that's really what it's all about. That's what Lucifer did. And that's what we tend to do on our own. And, of course, we have two choices. We can choose to do it God's way, or we can choose to do it our way.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do it our way, we're leaving ourselves open to all sorts of tragedy and unhappiness.
Right. And we're not to ask angels for help. You know, we don't pray to angels. Angels are only God's messengers and intermediaries and his helpers to do his will in the world. But we don't pray to angels. We have to keep that clear that, you know, there's been a tendency in the last few years for a lot of emphasis on angels in the wrong way, almost deifying them, and they are not gods. That was one thing I was trying to bring out in my book too, is how, you know, they're amazed at what goes on. They don't know everything.
Well, this idea that we have a guardian angel, I think we probably do have a guardian angel, but that doesn't mean that we look to the guardian angel for help.
Right.
Because the guardian angel is simply an agent of the one who sent them.
That's
to
right.
Look after us.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest this evening has been Ellen Gundersen-Traylor. Her book is Gabriel, the War in Heaven, and we'll be carrying that at Radio Liberty. If you'd like to find out more about, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. This is a fascinating look into what heaven may be like. We don't know whether it's going to be like, just like it, but it's a fascinating look into it. Well, Dr. Stan, I guess Ellen Gundersen-Traylor, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program here. So what are the thoughts that you would like to leave with our listeners this evening, Ellen?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier that this earth is not our ultimate home. This, you know, how the old song, this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. And for those of us who know the Lord and who have been redeemed, we have such a wonderful future, far beyond anything that's ever entered our minds. The Bible says it's beyond anything that's ever entered the heart of human beings, what God has prepared for us. And Jesus, when he was getting ready to leave this world, told his disciples, I'm going to prepare a place for you. In my Father's house or country or land are many mansions. And if it weren't so, I would have told you, but it is so, and I'm going to prepare a place for you. You know, it's a fabulous, wonderful comfort. It was for me when I wrote this book, thinking of my father now walking with angels, and he's having the great joy of experiencing the things that I can only vaguely imagine. So it was a great comfort to me. For Christians, it is a great comfort. It's our future home. It's also the home of those who've gone before us, who knew the Lord, who died in the Lord. And I just appeal to those of you who don't know Jesus Christ as your Savior, don't miss out on this fabulous adventure.
And, of course, I think the interesting thing is, as I read the book, I thought, you know, we focus our mind on heavenly things. Why, of course, this is where we're going to be looking, and this is what we're going to be thinking about. I read a lot of things that really are pretty morbid and pretty terrible, and sometimes I think I tend to dwell too much on that. And your book was such a refreshing thing, a refreshment for me personally, because it once again focused on my eternal home.
Right.
And, of course, that's what it's really all about. Yes, these other things we're involved in, I think, were important. I wouldn't be doing them if I didn't think they were important, if I didn't think that this we had an important message. But every once in a while, we've got to get back to what it's really all about. Mm-hmm. And it's not about simply educating people. It's trying to prepare them for the for an eternity with our Lord. And hopefully
right.
Some of the people who listen to our programs will be drawn in that direction. At least that's my hope. And that's my prayer. Well, Ellen, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always, it's a pleasure to have you. It was a challenging book to write. I think you did a magnificent job, and
I
hope many of our listeners will want to get it.
Well, I appreciate it, and I always enjoy it. Thank you.
Good night. God bless you.
Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here this evening. Our guest this evening was Ellen Gundersen-Traylor. Her book, Gabriel, the War in Heaven. And, of course, we carry a number of other of her books. I think we carry most of them that are in print. We carry Noah, Mary Magdalene, John, son of Thunder. Actually, both of those, John, son of Thunder, and Mary and Noah, are two of my favorites. Her book on Jerusalem, her book on Melchizedek, her book on certainly on the priest, the oracle, if you like, the Da Vinci Code. Why, you'd love these books, because they're written with the same fast-moving storyline. Very, very, very exciting books. But, of course, they point us towards the Lord, in contrast to Dan Brown's books, which, of course, are designed intentionally and purposely to destroy Christianity. And that's why, of course, the Da Vinci Code is being made into a movie today with Tom Hanks, because its purpose is to destroy your faith in Jesus Christ. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men, and you better understand what it's about. And you better choose the right side, or, well, eternity is an awful long time. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You can get the book, you can get the video, you can get the audio tape, you can get all three of them. And certainly we hope that you want to get the material, because it will point you exactly in the same direction we've been talking about this evening, and the nature of the spiritual battle that's going on. Ellen writes about the spiritual battle in heaven. I write about the spiritual battle that's going on earth. They're both very, very real. So the book, the Brotherhood of Darkness, the book, the video, the audio tape. And then, of course, we have so much other material that goes into that. I think that Ted Flynn's book, The Hope of the Wicked, is an excellent book, written very, very well. If you haven't yet heard the four tape set we have, interviews with Malachi Martin. It's called The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, a four-tape set. Whether you're Catholic or Protestant, you'll learn a great deal from the wisdom of this gentleman, who is no longer with us, but he did he shared so much with us when he was on our programs. And you'll get a glimpse of what's going on in the Catholic Church and the concern of one who is really faithful to the traditions, but certainly not to what was going on in the Church. And he was talking about the homosexuality in the Church long before it was ever exposed to the public. But he knew it. He knew it was there. And I talked to him off the air, and I said, you know, are the things you're talking about really going on? And he said, and that wonderful Irish brogue he had said, of course they're going on, but, you know, I can't necessarily write about it, so I have to write it in a fictional form. But all of the things, even the satanic sacrifice in the basement of the Vatican, they were all true. So you have to, the Wisdom of Malachi Martin, our four tapes out on Satanism and deliverance. And if you have not yet heard or watched our videos, they're called They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. Now, of course, we can get the 3, 4, or the 10-hour versions in video, and they're offering them in DVDs. It would take a while to get them ordered. If you want them, we can get them for you in DVDs. But you can get the videos right now. We will have those in stock, hopefully, by the first of the week. That's They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version. And I will promise you, we'll never let again look at the world through the same eyes after you see these videos. We carry the videos, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2. The Megiddo 1 is the story of the prophecies, the biblical prophecies and the false prophets, the Edgar Cayce's, the Nostradamus, and how we're headed into World War III. We're already on the way. They just haven't told the American people yet. You haven't seen your cities in rubble. And then, of course, the second Megiddo 2, 3 hours, very professionally done. The story from the Garden of Eden right to where we are today. And we're out of time. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.